Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. I actually cut our commercial short because it turns out we've got our connection to Egypt live right now. It's a little bit early, but we're going to go right now, right quickly, to Eric Maddox. He is the president of the Virtual Dinner Guest Project. He is live on the ground in Tahrir Square in Cairo. Eric, can I hear you?
Yes, we can hear you. Can you hear us?
Oh, yes, I hear you fine. Loud and clear. It's amazing. Modern technology. Very cool. So you, of course, are in Tahrir Square, right, in Cairo?
We're a few blocks away because it's way too noisy down there right now.
Okay.
But, yeah,
way
we're
too
like
crazy.
A foot walk.
Now,
so I've got a friend here with me who's actually on her way to do another television interview here in a few minutes.
Okay.
She's Egyptian. She's an activist. She speaks. She's been featured in documentary films.
And what's your
She's
name?
She's the one you want to talk to first.
All
I'll
right.
be around for a little while.
What's your
she
name?
Can introduce herself right now.
All right.
My name is Shema Helmi, and I'm an Egyptian activist from Cairo.
You're a
I've been part of the Egyptian revolution since day one, since last year, and I went to the United States on a speaking tour about my experience and got back.
Well, Shema, you're a very brave person. I'm curious to know this whole election between someone who represented the former government and someone who represents the Muslim Brotherhood. Was the whole election itself kind of an unhappy moment for people like yourself who worked for a newer, freer Egypt, free of perhaps both the Muslim Brotherhood and the former government?
Well, actually, I didn't take part in the elections. Neither the parliamentary elections or the presidential elections. I wanted to watch the process and in order not to, you know, be biased to a specific party or a specific group. I still don't think that Mubarak's regime has fallen down to begin with. Egypt is a military dictatorship since 60 years. So changing one person is not going to change the entire system.
So you don't
however,
think, go ahead.
I still think it's a good, you know, it's a good step forward, but it's not going to be the end.
So you don't think that Morsi, that your new president, the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, you don't think he'll have real power in Egypt?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you please repeat this again?
Your new president, Mohamed Morsi, do you think he will have real power, or do you think he'll be a figurehead and the military?
Do you think Morsi's going to have real authority?
Definitely not. I mean, looking at the constitutional declaration that was issued recently by the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, that grants them super authority and control over everything makes me a little bit suspicious about the rule that Morsi will have. I'm not quite sure like how much power or authority he will be able to handle under SCAF's rule.
But the fact that he was independently elected, should it mean at least they can't just put him in prison? I mean, he'll at the very, very least be able to speak out against the military, or do you fear they'll actually shut down his words as well?
Well, I mean, looking at what SCAF controls right now, what the military council controls, the intelligence, all the national security and all of these institutions, all the treaties that we have, all our relations with, you know, other countries, I don't think that Morsi's job will be easy dealing with these people. You know, the military controls around 40% of the economy in this country. It's a big deal.
So
what is he going to do about all of this? This is going to remain a big question.
Let me ask you this. Who appoints the military? Obviously, under Mubarak, you had a president from the military, and he would have decided the highest generals. Who controls them now?
Well, right before Mubarak resigned, he appointed the Supreme Council of Armed Forces. They are Mubarak's men. They served in the military next to him for years and decades. So they were chosen by Mubarak himself.
And this is the Supreme Military Council?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. You call this the Supreme Military Council? How many men are there on this council?
Around 19 generals, retired generals. All of them are over 60 years old. All of them served with Mubarak for over than 20 years. The head of the Supreme Council is Mubarak's Minister of Defense for 20 years. So I guess it's pretty clear how this entire council thinks and works.
Shema, I hear in the background, I hear noises that I hope are fireworks and not gunshots.
Yeah, they are fireworks.
Okay.
People are celebrating like crazy in the square right now.
So people are celebrating because Morsi was declared the winner.
Well, people have different reasons. The Muslim Brotherhood are obviously celebrating their candidate winning. other Egyptians are celebrating that Shafiq didn't win. Even if they didn't support Morsi, that was a victory in itself. The fact that the ex-member of, you know, the ex-minister of aviation and ex-prime minister of Mubarak didn't make it to presidency is a victory in itself for many people, even if they don't like the Muslim Brotherhood. And just the fact Morsi is, at the end of the day, an opposition, a part of the opposition, and he's a civilian. He's not a military man.
So what are the fears then with regard to the Muslim Brotherhood, with regard to Morsi? Are they are people afraid of an Islamicization of your of Egypt?
I actually heard this question like more than I can take now.
Okay.
It's kind of funny how people just focus on this side and nobody speaks about how the Muslim Brotherhood is pretty liberal compared to many other Islamist groups in Egypt, and how the Islamic political Islam and the Islamic current is so diverse that people in Egypt are not just gonna, you know, accept it. I think that the Muslim Brotherhood are pretty liberal compared to many other groups.
Do you think there'll be religious freedom? I mean, women won't have to wear burqas or anything, and Christians will be able to practice freely. Will there be religious freedom in Egypt?
I'm sorry, what are you saying?
Well, my question is about religious freedom in Europe. I don't want to see. Religious freedom in Egypt, will it be, will women have equal rights in Egypt following this election, do you think?
I mean, thinking about how the entire system is oppressive in itself, and how whether you are a woman or a man or a Muslim or a Christian, under a military rule, everyone is persecuted. So I think that if the Egyptian people... After all of this, I don't really think that the Egyptian people will allow something like this to happen. Thing is, the nature of the Egyptian society is so different than Saudi Arabia and Iran and Turkey and every other country. Egypt is such a special place. The relationship between Muslims and Christians are unique. And, you know, we have like people from all over the world visiting Egypt regularly. I don't think that this whole question of liberties... I mean, looking at how the military, for example, attacked women and done virginity tests on them and raped them in jail, and how they would, you know, attack female protesters and do all of these things. And they were not an Islamist government or anything.
Right.
So oppression is oppression, regardless of who's doing it.
And I want to be very clear, I certainly am not supporting the Mubarak government or Sharik or any of them. I was very active right here on this radio station arguing for the people who were demonstrating in Tahrir Square. I'm concerned about both sides, frankly, and I'm very concerned that the Egyptian government, as you say, the Supreme Council, will not give Morsi any real power. They said they were going to disband the parliament. Are there going to be new parliamentary elections then? Where they?
Yeah, they said that the we might have new parliamentary elections in January 2013. We're not sure what is going to happen. We're not sure what is going to happen with the constitution itself. SCAF has been thinking about definitely maintaining power and keeping all their authorities and privileges. So they need to make sure that the constitution is also under their control. I just want to say that people shouldn't just focus on the moment and think that we have succeeded, just like what they did in February the 11th in 2011 when Mubarak resigned and we were celebrating. It's very early. It's too early to celebrate right now when we have so many, many issues to deal with. So people should keep an eye. I mean, it's good that Morsi is a civilian and stuff and all of this, but we still need to deal with the constitution issue and the recent decree that SCAF has give authority to the military police to arrest people indefinitely and question them.
Yeah, that's the other thing I wanted to ask you about. There was, of course, the emergency law, which allowed Mubarak and to arrest anyone who was protesting him. That law was ended, but now it appears to have come right back a few days later.
Yeah, and also they have given not only the civilian police, but also the military police extra powers to arrest people, question them, and investigate.
Just so you guys know, unfortunately, Shema has to go,
okay.
But I'm happy to continue talking to you guys and telling you about
my impression. Thank you, Eric, and please thank Shema very much for sharing her views with us. I know there are lots of people who want her attention right now, and I just have to say she's very brave. People like her risk their lives to get the word out, and I want to thank her very much for coming here on The Inside Scoop. Please do that for me.
Absolutely.
Okay, so
Eric. So I'm here for as long as you need me.
All right. Well, let me go back to you then, Eric. So you are an American, obviously. I can tell from your accent. Yes. How did you end up in Cairo, and what are you doing there?
So I wound up in Cairo as part of a multi-country kind of odyssey throughout the Middle East and North Africa. I started in Beirut back in February, spent a month there, and then spent a month in Cairo. Miss Mosquito, I got it. Sorry, I'm handling a tea purchase right now as well. That's cool. We're actually sitting at an outdoor coffee shop.
How's your Arabic, Eric? Pretty good, huh?
I can get around, but no, I would not say good. Not conversational, just getting around.
Enough to order tea at a restaurant.
I've been in Lebanon, Cairo, and Tunisia, and kind of revisiting some of those places over the past 4 months. So I'm now on my second trip to Cairo. I've been here for about a month the second time, and I was here today and this afternoon for the election results.
And I want to ask you about all those countries. Frankly, at the end of the broadcast, I want to ask you about Lebanon and Tunisia as well. But for now, focusing on Egypt, were you there a year ago when they got rid of Mubarak? Were you there in Tahrir Square?
I was not here a year ago. I was actually in Egypt last 10 years ago. As an Arabic student, right after I completed my undergraduate studies. And I used to walk by Tahrir every day, and it has taken on a very different character, as I'm sure you can imagine, in the last year.
I'm sure. So but, when's the first time you visited Egypt since the revolution?
Yes.
This time is your first time since the revolution, this trip?
This trip is my first time since the revolution. I'm now completing my second month in Egypt. In my fourth month traveling in the region.
Okay, so you've been 2 months in Egypt. I assume you've had a chance to talk to a large number of people of different walks of life.
Yes.
Mostly in Cairo or all throughout the country?
Actually, I've been sticking to Cairo. I really want to expand to Alexandria, which is Egypt's second city up in the north, and get down to Upper Egypt, as it's called, which is actually the southern part of the country, because, Egypt is about more than just Cairo. But logistical concerns and just kind of being one guy wearing about 20 different hats at this project, it's been hard to get out of the city center.
But Cairo is a massively large city. I think it's, what, a third or more of the entire Egyptian population?
I don't know what it is percentage-wise of the population, but it's estimated at around 20 million, so it's a mega city.
It is massive. Definitely a mega city. So in Cairo, presumably, there are everyone from supporters of the government to Islamic fundamentalists to probably some Christians to lots of students. Give me an idea of some of the variation of views you hear from people. Just give me different people you've talked to. You don't have to give their names, but just describe them and who they are and what they think. Give me maybe five or six different views.
Okay, I'll do my best.
All right.
Sure. So I'd say there are definitely some Christians in Cairo and in Egypt. The Coptic Christian minority make up about 10% of the population. It's significant.
Yes.
And they have their own concerns.
What are their concerns?
Going forward politically. So that's one group right there, and I have had a couple of Copts participate in some of my dinner events. I should maybe back up and also say what my project is about.
Please,
really quickly.
Ahead.
So the gist of the project is really simple. It's connecting people around the world at their dinner tables using a video conference call and the concept of a shared meal to break down cultural barriers, promote media literacy, and social entrepreneurship. So you sit down, you have a video screen or a computer or a laptop at the end of your dinner table. We can do this with groups like NGOs. We can do it with classrooms. We can do it just with people sitting on street corners like I'm doing right now talking to you and connect them to other people in different countries, maybe where there's some sort of diplomatic impasse or conflict or just maybe a lack of knowledge, you know, like media can tend to like muddy the water as much as it clarifies things, depending on what the narrative is. So the idea is to start breaking down some of the stereotypes and some of the misconceptions and give people an opportunity to interact with one another directly.
And that's particularly important in the Middle East, I have to say.
That's exactly why I'm here. Yeah, because we're at a critical moment in Middle East history. It's going through a transitional period, and the history has not yet been written by any stretch.
Let's go through just various, if you will, typical views in Egypt. And you started with the Coptic Christians. I mean, they're 10% of the population.
Sure.
They're not typical, but it is 10%. So the Copts you talk to, they probably, my guess is, you tell me if I'm wrong, would be more supportive of the government because they're afraid of the Muslim Brotherhood, but maybe I'm wrong.
I could not make that statement.
Okay.
I'm sure that you could find some that are, but I don't think that I could paint it with like one brushstroke at all.
Tell me about the ones you talked to.
I think that the there's plenty of cops that you will find that, well, they might be have some concerns going forward about the nature of the government that they're going to live under. I think there's plenty of discontent from people of all different religious, socioeconomic, and ideological backgrounds in Egypt living under dictatorship.
What are the people shouting with the car horns? Did you hear the shouts? I heard
them. I'm sorry, I'm plugged into the computer.
Okay. No, I heard people shouting, and I was just curious what the chant was. But
a lot of what you're hearing is just Morsi today.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
And just and I don't know how much of that, to be honest, is people that are actually backers of the Ikhwan, like the Brotherhood, or just people that are really – I mean, there's the people that, like, voted for him because he's not the other guy, you know?
Right. Right.
Sound familiar?
No, absolutely. I probably would have voted for him myself as two extreme evils, but one slightly lesser evil than the other. I was very disappointed there was no third candidate that represented.
Well, there were many. They actually fielded quite a spectrum. Well, I don't know how ideologically diverse they were, but as far as numbers, there were quite a few candidates here in the first round of elections.
As I recall, one of them won 30% and one of them won 26% of the two final candidates, which means that 44%, or maybe it was higher than that, but practically half the country didn't vote for either of them. And it strikes me that if that half of the country had joined together among one compromise candidate, perhaps you could have had someone in Egypt that was neither Mubarak nor Muslim Brotherhood.
Hey, I mean, you got that, and you also that's the people that were even eligible to vote or turned out to vote, right?
That's true. So
what is it? Like something like, I think only 40% of eligible voters even turned out in this election. Something
low?
Like that.
Interesting.
Don't quote me, but that's telling, too. I mean, this is the first shot. "Quote unquote," like free and fair elections, right? And if that's your turnout,
it tells you about the confidence.
That's telling, right?
All right, so let's go back to each of the various examples.
I mean, for my project, I'll be honest with you. Like most of the people that are interested in participating right out of the gate are of a certain kind of political bent. I mean, they're open minded, kind of more the left end of the political spectrum. And that's not necessarily who I'm trying to attract. I think that if you want to resolve conflicts, you need to invite all stakeholders to the table, like in very literal sense. This is a dinner table.
Right.
So I want to have people from the Brotherhood, people from the Salafist movement, people that maybe are Shafiq supporters, and then, of course, like the liberal student movements and people that are just kind of your average workaday guy that's not all that political. I want all of them at the table.
Well,
but the people that have been coming are more of like kind of the student revolutionary set, and that's more or less who Shema represents here.
The student revolutionary set. They're probably the ones that at least most Americans can relate to more. They're more, perhaps more similar in character to us than the fundamentalist religious types or the government supporting types.
I would say that they're similar to a certain movement in the U.S., but I think that you can find people that maybe are more ideologically aligned with the religious right in this country than you might think.
Really?
The favor of the religion is a little bit different, but ideologically, as far as conservative values and just kind of wanting to have like stable governance, I mean, these are conversations that we're having in Western societies as well, you know? Like people that are willing to kind of sacrifice a little bit of freedom for security, it's economic or political.
Give me a first name, maybe. Of just a person you've talked to, and give me that person's view, and we'll just go through several people in each.
Sure, I'll do that. I don't feel terribly comfortable giving names, but what I can do is just kind of say, look, I've talked to people of this background. So I've talked to Salafists, which were referred to typically in the U.S. as like ultra conservative Muslims.
Okay. So we have Joe Salafist. That's my name. What does Joe Salafist think?
So, I mean, I can tell you what the guy I talked to thought.
All right.
I was on a street corner doing an English language interview with a buddy of mine during an April 20th rally. And he saw me and was wondering what I was up to. It's obvious that I'm a foreigner. And that arouses some suspicion here, especially in the last couple of days, I've noticed. People have been asking me what I'm doing. I've heard people murmur that I'm a spy. Had one guy threaten to break my camera. Everything's like been okay, actually. Most people have not been that way at all. This has been a couple of isolated incidents.
Okay.
But this particular Salafist guy, I turned the tables. Like he wanted to know what I was up to when he saw me interviewing one of his countrymen. And I said, look, man, I get it. I get why you're maybe a little bit concerned about what I'm doing here. So why don't you interview me? And I just gave my friend the camera, put the microphone on myself, and just told the guy, look, like, I'm an American in your country as a visitor. Ask me any question you want to about my country's foreign policy and my particular reasons for being here. And we had kind of an enlightening conversation, but he was the one leading it. Conservative views as far as U.S. support for Israel, but I think that you're going to find that is kind of a pretty universal sentiment in most segments of Egyptian society, with the exception of maybe those that are very pro-regime, pro-military. That's very much looked at as like kind of a purchased piece here in Egypt.
What were his views on the election? So he's a Salafist. So explain to my listeners what a Salafist is, first of all, because that's not
the right one. Sorry, I didn't hear the first part. Who's a Salafist?
Yeah, explain to my listeners what a Salafist is.
Yeah, Morsi is not a Salafist.
Right, he's Muslim Brotherhood. But Salafists are more religious, more fundamentalist.
Salafists, I think a fair way to characterize it would be like a more fundamentalist interpretation of Islam. And I guess it really means, I've asked many people to define what it means, but it's like following like the earlier, most pious adherence to the faith is their example, right? Okay.
So I call them fundamentalist Muslims. That's not far off.
I think you're going to get a different definition in different political contexts. I promise you, I'm not trying to be evasive here. These are questions that are great, and I've been trying to get answers myself. What a Salafist is in Tunisia right now is going to have maybe a different character than what it is in. And I've bumped into that too.
What does your guy who you talk to? What does he want? Does he want, for example, to restrict either what women wear or their rights at all? Does he have any views on how women should be treated in Egypt?
Well, that didn't come up in our conversation. What came up in the conversation was U.S. foreign policy.
Okay,
what came up in the conversation was I asked him what he said, like, why didn't you guys take care of Mubarak? And I just asked him, what do you mean? He said, like, why didn't you kill him? You know?
People assume that America has pretty much unlimited power.
Answer I gave him was I don't think that my country, given whatever it might be, should be in the business of executing foreign leaders. And people might like point the finger at us for behavior we've demonstrated in the past, but that certainly isn't the way I think that we should act going forward. And he seems to understand that.
What's his views about the future of Egypt on U.S. foreign policy?
Okay, I'm not going to so much allude to that particular interview because it wasn't really the character of it, but
we'll
I can tell you what I think I'm seeing on the streets. So I think that some of the Salafists have concerns about... Like the Salafist movement here maybe has more of a blue collar character, okay?
Okay.
And that the Brotherhood, while it's been an alternative or outsider party for decades here, is very well organized, very well funded, comparatively, and in some ways even looked at people as being kind of part of the establishment, you know, like kind of like maybe even the straw man.
And they're probably getting funding from what? Saudi Arabia presumably gives a lot of them funding.
There's questions about where money's coming from with a lot of these like post-regime governments, especially in Tunisia, right? But we're talking about Egypt today. But Saudi Arabia is looked at as being a potential funder, the Qataris as well, and that they have their competing interests that are funneling money from, as I understand it, and I'm reading the same news that you are. I'm not getting this on the streets. Like they're funneling money to parties that have a religious agenda.
Hang on, someone's screaming behind you. What's going on?
I mean, it's just people being people.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting outside right now at a coffee shop, which is kind of a big mainstay of Egyptian
social
culture.
I want you to give us some idea of what's going on around you. You are live in Cairo. We'll talk about the politics, and we'll get there. We have till 3 o'clock, but tell me what you're just seeing. Give us a bird's eye view for my radio listeners in Washington D.C. If they were sitting in the same coffee shop you were, what would they see?
All right, you see like kind of small groups of people streaming by slowly. Some of them are waving flags. Some of them are just kind of. It looks like they are at the end of their day. It was a really hot afternoon when it was packed in Tahrir.
It's what, 9 p.m. there, something like that.
It's now about 8:15 in the evening.
8:15, okay.
So people are just. I see a lot of Egyptian flags and a lot of people, big smiles on their faces. Occasionally, cars and. The ubiquitous, like, scooters streaming by, people honking their horns, and it's a celebratory atmosphere.
And you were there all day pretty much in Tahrir Square, which must have been crazy crowded. I'm probably packed with human beings.
Like sardines in a can and super duper hot. It's the Middle East in the middle of it's in the summertime, you know?
So it's hot anyway, and then you have all those bodies pressed against you. Was there any violence or even something close to violence that you saw?
Absolutely none that I saw.
How about military presence or police presence?
I saw none.
None. So basically, the military government who's running the place right now, according to virtually everyone, they've seen foot, at least for today, to stay out of sight.
I think that's actually been pretty typical. This isn't the first or necessarily even the biggest rally that I've been to here, although it's amongst the biggest. And I've never really seen a military presence at any of them. I think that a lot of people maybe would have that faulty assumption because they know that it's a military government and that there's concerns about like political instability and with all the clashes that were happening, obviously, during the actual revolutionary period. But they're kind of out of sight most of the time, unless something really nasty is going down. Maybe they can be looked at as being the cause of it. I don't know. But I really haven't seen the military out in force ever. And I've probably been to, like, I don't know, close to half a dozen major protests or rallies in Tahrir in my time here.
It's interesting to see if, like that. If something happens in the next few months, it may be that they think that at this point would be the worst time to do a crackdown because the people would absolutely revolt and they'll wait. I mean, well,
maybe that's a good place to segue into like what I think is actually going on here.
All right, go ahead.
And I think what's going on here is this business as usual with a different face on it. And I'm no like professional political analyst. I've spent some time in the region. I've done some research out here, but I'm not an expert on Egyptian history or politics by any stretch. But my take on it is this, man. Like, Egypt's been under military rule for decades. And you have a military government that's overseeing a transition from military rule. I mean, who are we trying to kid here, right? I mean, it's a classic example of the foxes guarding the hen house. It's completely counter to their interest to give up an inch of power. And sure, they'll let a quote-unquote Islamist or opposition party member win the election, but keep in mind that just a week ago, they just dissolved parliament, and for the past several days, because the outcome of this election was delayed, it was supposed to, I think, have been released on Thursday, if I remember right, it was delayed. I'm sure that what was happening in dark corners was a negotiation over what kind of powers whoever won the presidency was going to be given.
Why
right?
do you think they dissolved the parliament a week before the election rather than afterwards? Because the president would be against it, the newly installed president? Is that why they did it before they announced the results?
Your guess is as good as mine. It sounds like, yeah, I think it's a chess match. You know, if they're in power when the president comes to power, I don't know. Maybe it's a little bit more difficult to make that kind of like obvious draconian move, you know? So I think that it's, I think what we have is an example of like the military allowing for like the outward appearance of some sort of like change or transition toward democracy. But you need to understand that I think the American audience needs to understand that this all comes down to, as much as it does in our own country, economics. You know, who controls the flow of capital, and who has access through their money and their moneyed interest to the leadership. And that's absolutely the case here in Egypt. The Egyptian military controls upwards of a third of the Egyptian economy. If, no matter who gets into power, no matter how much of a mandate they have, if they turn off the spigot on the economy, they can absolutely hamstring whoever's in power overnight and then blame them for it. So who knows what mechanisms are ultimately going to be used if the elected leadership here decides to kind of go rogue, if you will, like actually pursue their own independent agenda. But they can be on a pretty short leash vis-a-vis the military establishment here. Have no illusions about it. I don't buy into the idea that what we're seeing is a transition toward democracy because we've seen an election here at all.
So the rich people,
and I think a lot of my friends in the Sudan feel the same way.
So the rich people in Egypt are pretty much all connected to the military? There's no independent businessmen's wealth or anything like that, small business. It's really
okay, but now this is another interesting question. And again, this is like me doing my best to kind of regurgitate to you what I'm hearing on the streets, okay? So I'm not an expert. But my understanding is we're focusing too much in the U.S. on the Muslim part of the Muslim brotherhood and not enough on the brotherhood part. I think what you've really got going on here isn't so much like a political party with a strong Islamist agenda. What you've got is a fraternal organization that's functioning as a cartel or as a mafia, competing with another mafia that's been running the country for decades, and that's the military. They both have huge stakes in the economy and function as insular organizations that really serve the interests only of the people that support them. So this is true of the Brotherhood, from what I understand, and the military. They just have competing interests, so on occasion, the Brotherhood will have some of its leadership or its membership thrown into prison. But this isn't necessarily the voice of the people, however the Brotherhood is trying to characterize.
That frankly, I've been concerned about all over the Arab world. And we're going to talk a little bit about
Lebanon. Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, this has been a concern I've had all over the Arab world. We're going to talk a little bit about Lebanon and Tunisia as well. We'll definitely get there. But my concern, it seems that there's always this choice between two evils, between either a military dictatorship that is clearly oppressive and torturing the people, and it's an awful thing, or you tend to have these groups like the Muslim Brotherhood or Hamas comes to mind, or other groups that also have their sort of mafia elements, and where if you're not loyal to them, you can be harmed, you can be killed. Mm-hmm. Is there any hope for a third movement that is neither related to the government?
We're breaking up a little bit, but I think I get the thrust of what you're saying.
Yeah. I'm looking for the hope for a third movement.
Any hope for, I think you're asking me, is there any hope for a third party? Is
yes, that... yes, something that's not government and not Muslim Brotherhood.
That's kind of the, how much money are we giving to Egypt in the U.S.? Like, that's like
$1.5 billion.
$1.2 billion question, isn't it? So I think that, yeah, I'm sorry?
Yes, go ahead.
I didn't hear you breaking up. Sure.
No, that's
so,
exactly
I mean, that's
question.
A whole other can of worms we might want to open up at some point. And that's U.S. support for the military establishment and what might end up being support for the Brotherhood as well, as long as they keep the status quo politically and economically in the region. So, and from what I understand, the Muslim Brotherhood is absolutely willing to play ball along economic lines, and that might be enough for our government to give them their blessing.
But Eric, I want you to address
blessing.
So we're breaking up.
As far as opportunities
movement.
For a legitimate or viable third party, I couldn't. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, I can hear you. I know our Skype is breaking.
Am I losing? Okay. Okay, so as far as the third party question in Egypt, you know what? Like, I wish that I could.
I think we may have lost our connection. All right, I'll tell you what. I really want to hear Eric's answer to that question, but I'm afraid we've lost our connection. So unless Eric has called back in, which I don't know. No. All right. So this is Mark Levine. This is the Inside Scoop. We will get back. We are live on the ground in Cairo, in Egypt.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm
oh, you
here.
Are there. Excuse me. Okay, we lost you for a
second. Yes, sorry, I lost you for a second.
Go ahead. Go back. So I was asking you about a third choice between a Knight of Muslim Brotherhood nor Mubarak.
So, yeah. It's not going to come without a fight. I think what we're seeing are like T-shirts being sold on street corners commemorating like the revolution here, and even seeing being sold in the airport. And I think that that's kind of a telling sign that it's like very quickly been kind of commercialized. And really, there's nothing that's on the ground a certainty here as far as people's like free political futures going forward. I don't think that it's going to be delivered by the military overseeing it. That's a joke, an absolute farce to think that they're going to hand over power. And the Muslim Brotherhood, I can't see that I got a whole lot of faith in them either, unless they stand up as a legitimate voice of opposition to the ruling class and the regime here. I think that what we've probably had over the course of the last 3 days is them being co-opted quietly by SCAF.
Okay, but see,
so
Eric, here's my question.
The presidents.
So half the Egyptian population, or more than half, didn't vote. Of the ones that did vote, a plurality, and maybe even a majority, did not vote for either the Muslim Brotherhood candidate nor the government candidate. So it sounds to me like there is a whole mass of Egyptians that don't fall into those two camps. They would just need organization, right? A strong leader, it seems to me.
I see what I think you got to look at the character of those other candidates.
Right. So is
right?
there
and
a
I think that
the,
it wasn't like
they could pull together this third party? Do you think there's
a huge panel of secularists that existed outside of the option for Shafiq Morsi? There were plenty of other people that had religious faith. Do I think that there's always an opportunity, but do we see like an actual person, like an actual leader emerging?
Yes.
As a legitimate voice? There's people like Al-Baradei, who I hear every once in a while, the former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And from what I understand, he didn't run in the election. A lot of my friends just boycotted it outright because they didn't really believe in any of the candidates. They boycotted.
I'll tell you what, we're having enough technical problems that I think what I'm going to do is go to a break and I'll recall Eric back. So that we can bring him on the air and not have these breaks. If you want to dial in, it's 202-889-9797. Eric, we're having
Hello.
Some technical problems. I guess you called back in again?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm kind of drifting in and out.
Okay, so, yes, you are. If it drifts out enough, I'll go to the commercial break. But go ahead.
answer your question, not sure how much you got, but sure. So I mean, if it's telling at all, a lot of or a number of my friends and kind of like the student revolutionary set didn't bother voting in the first round of elections either.
None of the 12 candidates didn't see
any of the candidates that were fielded as being all that enticing.
None of them? Not even one of the 12?
There was like, even with like the field of how many was it, like 9 candidates or something? It was a significant number. They were saying, look, like, even this is a case of picking the least worst. And many of them didn't bother to vote even.
Why didn't a student run? Why didn't Shema run?
Why didn't she vote?
But why didn't she run? Why didn't a student leader run? Someone that clearly represented the people of Tahrir Square. Why didn't one of them run? Were they disqualified?
Okay, well, my speculative answer to that question is that the game is rigged from the outset because SCAF is calling all of the shots, right? So, and this is a question that should have been asked about the Iranian Green Revolution a few years ago, too, but it got a different kind of play in the West. That was that people protested in the streets about a rigged election between the two candidates in Iran, right, several summers back. But there were only 4 people that were even allowed to run in that election.
Right.
By the mullahs, right? I think that maybe, I don't know how much of an analogy we can draw here, but I think that maybe is worth looking at, right? That it's, sure, you can have a field of 30 candidates if you want, and if at the end of the day, it's whoever gets the blessing of SCAF that's going to hold power. Maybe it really protesting by non-participation is really the best way to go. I can't say I would have done it differently.
Now, I was talking with Shema about SCAF, the Supreme Military Council. I don't know exactly what
Supreme Council of Armed Forces.
Okay, Supreme Council of Armed Forces. And she was telling me they were all chosen, 19 or 20 of them, by Mubarak at the outset. Is there any hope for changing the composition of SCAF and actually having a more democratically chosen military leadership? Or is that pie in the sky?
I don't see how you change that kind of institutionalized corruption and self-interest from within. I just don't. I mean, it's been a part of Egypt's political composition since independence, you know?
Well,
it's always lived under a military leader.
So is there any hope here? I mean, the Egyptian people come out in mass. A lot of them are very excited today. They fill Tahrir Square. They chant a lot of slogans. Is there any hope for Egypt's future? Because I got to say, both you and Shema both sound pretty pessimistic. What can
I don't
happen?
Share the optimism of a lot of the people in the street tonight. What I assume to be optimism based on gauging from the population. But I would ask this question if I can ask a question of myself.
Go ahead. Sure.
What can Americans do to make a difference?
If we stop giving
that's part of why I'm here. I've got some concerns about where my U.S. tax dollars are being spent.
A lot
of them are going to Egypt historically. Historically, Egypt's been the second largest recipient of U.S. tax dollars in the world.
So do you think gave less money to Egypt or we condition that aid on certain democratic reforms, that would play a major role in creating a brighter future for the Egyptian people?
I think I heard most of the question. I certainly don't think it would hurt. I think it's a place to start. And I think that the Egyptian economy relies on more than just U.S. military aid. I mean, I'm not naive. But are you back?
Yes. Sorry. We do keep having trouble. I didn't hear your response to my question about what ending military aid.
Okay. So here's the deal, I think, with Egypt. It's a few months ago, and Hillary Clinton kind of held her nose and signed over another check to SCAF for military funding.
And they
this kind of went widely unnoticed, I think, in most of the U.S. And actually, to be honest, I think a lot of Egyptians aren't even aware that they're getting funded by the U.S. Shaima wasn't herself aware until a few months ago, you know. So why did we fund them? Why did we not hinge that on military or political reforms? Well, it means American jobs. Consider that American aid goes to the Egyptian military, which turns around and purchases arms from U.S. weapons manufacturers. That means U.S. jobs. This is why, like, for example, like that F-22 fighter legislation was so hard to kill, even though our own defense secretary was insisting on it a few years back. Do you remember that? It's the same scenario. So it's really what it comes down to is Main Street in the U.S., concerns that politicians have about their own constituencies and losing votes. If they make decisions about our foreign policy that affect their constituency back home.
So you would say that the main thing that Americans could do to promote democracy in Egypt would be to encourage our government to either end aid or condition aid on having democratic reforms such
absolutely.
As...
Absolutely. All right. Absolutely. We should be doing it with Israel, too. We should be doing it with all of the undemocratic regimes that we're funding around the world. And people might characterize Israel as a democracy, but if you're marginalizing 15% of your passport-holding population, you're not. I think that aid should be based on those kinds of political incentives. Human rights. Personally, I think we should just get out of the region entirely. If you want my unvarnished opinion, I don't think that we have any business having a military presence in the Middle East or throwing our money around this part of the world. We've lost our credibility over decades
on some of that, but I'll tell you
supporting authoritarian rule.
Well, that's true. When you come back in the States, you and I can have a longer debate on that. Right now, I'm mostly using you as eyewitness. I'll tell you this. I have to take a quick commercial break. But when we come back, I want to talk about Tunisia and Lebanon because, of course, there's some similarities but also some vast differences to what's going on in Egypt. So if you'll just hang on with me, Eric, I'll also try to, frankly, improve your Skype connection if I can during the break. Folks, if you want to call in and join this discussion, it's 202-889-9797, 202-889-9797, or you can call toll-free at 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back with Eric Maddox live from Egypt, live from Tahrir Square, right after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine reporting live at React Radio, 1480 AM. If you want to dial in, it's 202-889-9797 or call toll-free 888-488-MARK. If you dial in, you will have a special treat because I am talking live with Eric Maddox. He is an American in Egypt. He is in Cairo. He is a block or two away from the throngs at Tahrir Square who are celebrating, although, let's face it, there's a lot of pessimism in Europe that Eric is talking about, but celebrating at least the fact that a non-government candidate has been able to take over the presidency. Although, as Eric has very clearly pointed out, as did the Egyptian activist with him, a woman by the name of Shema, just because Morsi is allowed to be president of Egypt does not mean he's in control. Control is still by the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, or SCAF, and they are very much in charge. Eric, I've been told by my producer here that there's really nothing we can do about our Skype connection. It's not a problem on our end. It's a problem end in Egypt. Yeah, sure. And so if you lose the connection, just keep calling back in as you've been doing. It's actually good when you call back in, but if it starts getting bad, we'll just leave it up to you to call back in when that happens, all right?
No problem.
All right. So I want to move on to Tunisia and Lebanon. Before I do, is there anything else you want to say about Egypt?
Oh, well, I could go on for hours, Ben, but yeah.
Is there anything I've missed in this analysis that you think is really important to bring out?
I think that what I'm trying to do with my project and what I would ask Americans to do in general is to start asking questions about where their money's going, you know, that other people end up paying for our interests in a lot of ways, and not necessarily American interests, but American policy interests or government interests,
or multinational
interests. With their freedom. And it's really a pity. It's been going on in this part of the world for decades, and it undermines American credibility and moral authority. It does nothing to serve American interests to be supporting autocrats.
Let me go, if I could, from the pessimism of Egypt to a place where I at least have some optimism, and that's Tunisia, and then we'll descend to the ultimate pessimism that is Lebanon, but we'll get to there last. Tunisia, at least from this vantage point, thousands of miles away in Washington, D.C., seems to be the best success story of the Arab Spring. The people went in there. They overrode a dictator in Tunisia. But there, the population, they have more money than in Egypt. They're more literate than in Egypt. Most of Tunisia is basically around a few cities. And so the general theory, at least here, is that this is the Arab Spring Revolution most likely to succeed to become a secular democracy. What are your thoughts?
Oh, wow. I would say that I know a lot less about Tunisia, and it is a different ball of wax. My impression there is you have an Islamist party, Ennahda, that already took control.
But you don't see people
being forced to wear veils or implement Sharia law. That's really not the character that's taken. In fact, some people have criticized them for being a little bit too lukewarm, not necessarily religiously, but just as far as any kind of major change. So that's a criticism that I've heard on the street in Tunisia. And it's a different kind of culture. You know, their colonial history is different. It's more of a Francophone country, and very French in character.
So would you agree then that Tunisia has the best chance of success, success being defined?
Never been to France, but I kind of felt like I had been after spending a few weeks there.
Well, it seems to me like it's more likely to be a
democracy. I don't know if that goes to answer your question, but you've got to...
That respects human rights. That's my question. Is that where Tunisia is going to go in the next 5 or 10 years, if you had to predict?
Oh, I lost you. Can you define success?
Well, I define success as a democracy that respects human rights, that respects minority rights, but allows free elections and a fair press.
Mm-hmm.
Are you following me?
Hmm. Yeah, I think I hear that. So free press, human rights, democracy. Like
right,
open
protection of minority rights, all of that. Yeah, Tunisia seems to me the most likely candidate for success in those terms. What do you think? Am I too optimistic?
I don't think that's too optimistic. I think that it's early to tell, that they're still very much going through a transitional period right now. And I don't know what kind of economic drivers are motivating people's political decisions there. But, I mean, what I can tell you is, like, the general mood on the street when I was there didn't seem to be downtrodden. Just kind of seemed to be universal recognition of, like, it's not over yet, you know? Like, we're still kind of in the middle of this thing. But it's a very kind of liberal society in a lot of ways. You see women dressed wearing the veil, but also as much as they do in any Western country.
And would you say that optimism in Tunisia is not shared in Egypt, that people are very pessimistic in Egypt?
I think that, like, based on some of the numbers that you're giving too, right, it's pretty hard to generalize in Egypt. If you got half the population not turning out to vote, what does that mean? Did they not care, or are they pessimistic? If you've got the people that do turn out to vote only having a couple of candidates that some are enthusiastic about and many are just choosing the lesser of two evils, is that... Does that sound like optimism, or is it just, look, like, this is where we're at in the process of change, and it's not going to happen overnight? So I think that, I mean, personally, me, like, looking at what some of the stumbling blocks are to fair governance in Egypt, they seem profound, profoundly entrenched and institutionalized, and not looking like they're going to be letting up or changing their character anytime soon. I don't see SCAF, like, looking like it's going to step down. In any meaningful way on the horizon, despite what they might be saying, their actions would indicate otherwise. And I don't think that I'd have the same like analysis of what's happening in Tunisia.
Let me move on to the third country that you visited, and probably my guess would be the most depressing, even more depressing than Europe. I could say that Lebanon is a basket case, but that's nothing new. Lebanon has been a basket case ever since the Lebanese Civil War in the 1970s. And that's really a shame because most Lebanese people I've met are wonderful people who very much want peace. But Lebanon has been used by Syria, by Israel, by the United States, by Iran, by Palestinians, by you name it. Someone has used Lebanon for their own purposes. And now that in Syria, the people are revolting against the Assad government, my understanding is that revolution, that civil war, is going over into Lebanon as well. So that's my analysis.
Sorry, I lost you.
You couldn't hear my analysis, sorry, because of the Skype. What's your analysis of what's going on in Lebanon?
No, I got most. I think I got the gist of it.
Okay.
I got the gist of it, I think. I would disagree with the characterization that it's been a basket case since the 70s.
Okay.
The Civil War ended quite some time ago.
Right. But
there was another war, as you probably remember, with Israel in 2006 with Hezbollah. But really, what I've seen is a pretty vibrant society and very pluralistic, of course. So there's depending on who you ask, between 17 and 20 different factions, that not counting Palestinians, in Lebanon. But I didn't see a basket case when I was there. I saw a lot of Porsches and plastic surgery and nightclubs.
Well, here's what I'm hearing, like, reported, that the massacres that Assad is perpetrating in Syria are already going across the border into Lebanon. That's what I've seen in the Washington Post. Do you dispute that?
Massacres?
Yeah.
That are
actually
into Lebanon. Right. Well, see, I was there in February, mid-February to mid-March. I'm getting ready to go back.
Okay.
And I'm curious to see what kind of Lebanon I'm ready to go back to. I'll be going back to. But I didn't leave a place that was in chaos or turmoil. There was some fighting up north in Tripoli, which is maybe an hour's drive from Beirut. And more of like a Sunni community. Beirut is kind of more representative of Lebanon at large, with many different factions. And yeah, you had fights in the streets between Salafists and Alawis, like the same religious minority group that rules Syria. And I think that there's absolutely been spillover from the Syrian conflict. I think it's a question we need to be asking in the West, and I hope that we are starting to ask it more. From what you're saying, it sounds like we might be. And that is, what happens when Assad goes down?
Who's running Lebanon right now? Is it Hezbollah? Is it Syria? Is it individual parts are run by Christians or Sunnis or Shias, and depending on where you are? The Lebanese government seems notoriously weak. Who's running the place?
That's a really good question, and this might actually be also a part of why they didn't experience a revolution in this past year. There was the Cedar Revolution, I think, in 05 after their prime minister, former prime minister, was assassinated, and this was what led to the Syrian withdrawal.
Right.
But in the last year, it's been kind of politically silent, and part of that is that there isn't really, in the formal sense of the word, a government in Lebanon. Who are you going to kick out, you know? You don't have a Ben Ali, you don't have a Mubarak to just point the finger at and say, you know, we don't necessarily know what we want, but we don't want that guy. You know, like, we know we don't want the autocrat to be in power anymore. We'll figure out the details later. That scenario is not possible in a country where you don't really have a single group or individual to oust you. You've
so
got political
local control
between
then?
Christian groups and groups like Hezbollah, which tells you something about like the Islamist agenda of an organization that's willing to ally itself with Christian militant groups. That what Islam means, what political Islam means in this part of the world, is typically more complicated than people are willing to explore in the Western press. I know Christians have voted for Hamas in the 2006 elections.
Right.
The narrative is often fairly way too simple.
But, yeah, and they were mostly the followers of Michel Aoun, I believe. But I guess my question is this. Is it local control? Like, you go to one neighborhood in Beirut, and it's Hezbollah. You go to another neighborhood, it's Christian militants. You go to another neighborhood,
yeah, I mean,
it's Sunni.
If I'm just going off of, like, what I'm seeing, that having, like, I'm not going door to door, you know,
right,
my canvas. But, like, walking through different neighborhoods, that's absolutely, like, what I've seen. That you go into one neighborhood, and you see the flags of Amal, which is a Shia party, sometimes allied to Hezbollah. You see the Hezbollah flags in other neighborhoods. Then remember that there's Palestinian refugee camps scattered around the country as well. So you'll see the Fatah flags as well when you enter into those camps, and posters of Arafat and Saddam Hussein. And then in the neighborhood that I was living in, it was a Christian enclave. So it was Christian militias, Falangist groups, and others. They had their graffiti sprawled all over the wall marking their territory. And then there's
Syrian
an Armenian
influence.
Community as well.
Do you see Syrian influence? The
it's
Syrian military?
Just a few feet from where I was living. So it's highly factionalized. Yes, I'd say that the green line in Beirut isn't like meaning what it used to mean. You walk across like the center of town that used to be like a no man's land and get you shot going into the wrong community. Not.
How about Syria? Do you see Syrian?
Not at all now. I mean, it's just a traffic median strip with a Virgin Records. Do I see Syria? What?
Do you see Syrian forces anywhere, or the evidence of Syrian forces?
No. They pulled out in 05. They've been gone. Now, the question is to whether or not they've just symbolically pulled out or remain a part of the military intelligence establishment and have. I'm sure their political interests are still well entrenched in Lebanon, and they have their big proxy, also a co-proxy of Iran's in Hezbollah, right? So in that sense, I mean, how much of a formal presence do they need to have with boots on the ground when they've got one of the largest and most powerful non-state actors in the region right there, is a Lebanese fighting force themselves? How much, like, Hezbollah is firmly in the back pockets of the Assad regime? Well, the rhetoric would seem to indicate that that's more or less the case, but I don't know if there's a pressure point there, if there's a place where they would part ways.
You mentioned the war with Israel in 2006. One of the main negotiating points to get Israel to withdraw was a United Nations resolution where the West promised to disarm Hezbollah. I forget the number of that resolution, but is it fair to say that no one's enforcing that resolution? Hezbollah is more armed and more powerful than ever.
I couldn't give you statistics on that. I don't see anything to indicate that they've lost their military might.
Yeah, I don't think any disarmament's done. So what happens if the Syrian Free Army wins and Assad is removed from office? If the Syrian Free Army prevails, and I think they might, and it might take another couple years, but if they prevail and Assad is removed from office, what happens to Lebanon?
Great question. And similar kind of to the Libyan scenario, in the sense that we should be asking the question, who are they? You know, who are the guys that are fighting the guys that we don't like? Do we really know who they are?
I've had a few of them on my show, actually. That doesn't mean they're necessarily telling me the truth.
Some of them are Libyans that are in Syria right now fighting the Assad regime.
Not the ones I was talking to, but fair enough.
Sure. And I have no doubt that the people you were talking to were legitimate. I have no reason to believe otherwise, but I'm saying that I think that you might have a plurality of interests involved in some of the changes that are going on in the region. You know, that it's not just a clearly defined, like-minded opposition to Assad, nor was it, I think, in Libya. And so people should be asking those questions.
But what happens to Lebanon?
Starting to get, what will happen to Lebanon?
Yeah.
Well, I think that kind of part and parcel with the question that I'm raising is who wins? Assad goes down, who is it that won, you know? There's competing interests even in the opposition to Assad. So if he goes down at the hands of Salafists, foreign jihad movements, well, this is going to maybe take on a different character and bode differently for Lebanon's political destiny than it will if it's a secular pluralistic movement, you know? So I think that that's really what we should be looking at is who is it that's fighting the guy? And that will determine, I think, a lot. And if he does go, what does instability in Syria mean for the political destiny of Lebanon? I'm sure this is where your question's coming from.
Yeah.
And that's a huge variable.
The other question I have...
Do we know who's fighting Assad? You know, do we know who's funding him? Because we know that there's Gulf money flowing into that, to the opposition. They're very open about it.
Yeah, although some of the opposition I talked to said they weren't seeing any of the aid from the Gulf. So even the opposition is divided, frankly, on that score. My question,
exactly.
I guess, is about Lebanon, is if it's even governable. You know, before 1970s, there was definitely a Lebanese government and an institution and people, you know, a Lebanese flag. People are very proud to be Lebanese. I wonder now, with 17 or 20 factions controlling every different neighborhood in Beirut and throughout the country, whether no matter who wins in Syria, no matter what happens, whether Lebanon really can continue to exist as a nation or whether it will continue to be 20 different localized groups, each controlling their locality. I mean, is there any hope for a unified Lebanon in the future?
Well, I would go back to the history and say that I don't know how rosy things were before the Civil War.
Okay.
Lebanon is an interesting case study, and it's been kind of a playing ground for different political ideologies around the region. You know, it's like a testing ground.
Absolutely.
You see that, like, definitely demonstrated in the case of Hezbollah being a proxy of Syria and Iran, but there's other countries that have their interests there as well. You see a lot of Gulf money flowing into that, into Beirut.
Sure.
I mean, whether or not it's arming ideologies or just changing the skyline. It's there, present and influential in many ways, I'm sure. And of course, there's the traditional actors in the West that have their interests in the Lebanese political future. So is it possible for it to be a unified country? Well, I don't know. I mean, I personally know Lebanese that come from a lot of the different factions. I don't know if I know someone from all 17, you know, but I know people that are, I know Lebanese Armenians, Christians, Muslims. And Palestinian refugees living in Lebanon, and they all more or less want the same thing, you know. Like they want to be living in peace. There's a conflict fatigue in that country, sure. And I mean, that's another thing to be looking at is maybe this is a huge part of why there isn't more instability there, or hasn't been at least up to this point. And that's the same question that can be raised about Algeria, where there's a massive bloodletting and a civil war that they had.
Right.
People can only suffer so much before they just think, look, like, we just need a breather, you know?
Sure.
Like, enough with the bloodletting.
I wonder if, though, that perhaps we shouldn't complain too much, as I'm talking with you and thinking out loud, about 17 groups controlling 17 or 1700 different neighborhoods throughout the country of Lebanon. Perhaps local control is the way out, whether in Afghanistan or anywhere else, where basically, all right, this is a Shia area that likes Hezbollah. Hezbollah controls this neighborhood. The Christians control their neighborhood. The Sunnis control theirs. The Palestinians control their refugee camps. And, you know, the Greek Circassians their own as well. True autonomy for each individual. And they already have an extremely weak national government anyway.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the answer. What do you think?
I think maybe I can answer by way of, like, anecdote.
Okay.
I mean, for whatever it's...
Sure.
I've found that, like, if I can use, like, the example of me being able to walk freely down the street in any of these places is an indicator of stability. And maybe it's a problematic example, but I've walked walked into just about all of the neighborhoods you've described in Beirut, you know, and into refugee camps as well. And I've never feared for my safety or my life. And that's the picture of the Middle East that I would really want to change in people's minds is that, yeah, it's tumultuous at times, and people have suffered here. There's long-standing suffering going on, but they're also some of the kindest people I've met, almost without exception in all of my travels. Can leave a laptop computer sitting and probably on this cafe table, go around the block, and come back a half an hour later, it'll still be here. I wouldn't do that in my own hometown in the U.S. And I've actually tried that scenario before in Beirut, you know, and nothing's happened. So, I mean, that if that's any indicator that there's something similar in each of the neighborhoods that you're describing, whether they're controlled by Hezbollah, whether they're controlled by Christian militias or any of the other actors, I can move with equal like safety amongst all of those communities as an American that sticks out like a sore thumb. And maybe I'll get an occasional suspicious glance here in Cairo, but the times are tense. And really, like, if I take the time to stop, shake someone's hand, explain, look, I'm here as a friend, and I just want to see how I can support you guys in trying to have, like, a freer society going forward, let me know what I can do, you know? I'm here with an open mind and willing to listen.
Do you think, you talk about a populace being tired of war, that's certainly true in Lebanon, I'm sure, after, I mean, decades of instability. Do you think that in Tunisia and Egypt, which were relatively stable, don't get me wrong, stable under the thumb of a terrible dictator in both cases, but do you think
I'm sorry.
I was just saying that in Tunisia and Egypt, unlike in Lebanon, mm-hmm. really haven't had a lot of strife. You know, they have more homogeneous societies. They definitely were under the thumb of military dictators that were torturing people and were awful human beings. But at the same time, they haven't had the kind of inter-neighborhood, you know, fractional warfare that Lebanon mm-hmm. has had. Do you think that, therefore, the people of Tunisia and Egypt, who are much more unified in their countries, are more likely to come with a unified...
See, I lost you there for a second.
Sorry. My question is whether the people of Tunisia and Egypt might come up with a more unifying solutions. We talked about Lebanon. It's very much 17 different groups. But Tunisia and Egypt are more homogeneous. They haven't undergone the kind of strife that Lebanon has undergone. Mm-hmm. Will they, do you think, work it all out eventually? Tunisia and even in Egypt, where you know, they'll get past SCAF, they'll get past these difficulties and move on to a brighter future.
I think that there's room for optimism there.
Okay.
I think that it is worth noting that they are more homogeneous societies in a lot of ways. Now, you've got competing interests along the ideological spectrum, even within Islam, as I'm sure you're aware and discussing on your show. So you can be of the same faith and have different takes on how it should be practiced.
Absolutely.
And who knows how that will manifest itself going forward, of course. And again, I want to emphasize that there is a sizable Christian minority in Egypt that has been used historically as kind of a distraction from some of the evils of the regime. There were church bombings that were going on here before the revolution. And there's at certain points as it was unfolding, there was fighting between Muslims and Christians here. But a lot of people here will tell you, or at least the few that I've spoken to, I should say, that a lot of that's prompted by the government. Even some of the fighting that you're seeing, I want Americans to know this too, the fighting that you might see, as rare as it is, at some of these rallies in Egypt, it's really common to hear from people on the streets, that, look, these are thugs that are being paid by the government to come in and mess with us, to intimidate our women, and to make it look like we're up to no good. And this is routine. The Egyptian government's been doing this for decades. So just something to keep in mind if you actually do start seeing some fighting, if that does happen in the streets here in the next few days, that a lot of times those are actually government actors, that those are thugs. I see the plainclothes policemen hanging out the sides of troop-carrying vehicles here all the time. Just wearing flip-flops and dressed like civilians.
It's interesting.
I have no illusions about the fact that the government SCAF has its own agenda.
On this show a few weeks back, we had people from the Syrian Free Army, and they said the same thing about Syria.
Sorry, go ahead.
Just some of the worst massacres in Syria were done by exactly that, plainclothes thugs paid by the police to do those horrible massacres.
So yeah, that's actually seen it in Iran, common. Too, with the Basij.
Absolutely.
Very common. It's pretty
common.
Tried and true tactic of authoritarian rule.
That's true.
And but I don't want to like digress too much into pessimism again here. Like the point being that yes, I think that you raise a really good point, and that is that maybe there is some hope for a little bit more solidarity in places where there aren't these divisions. But even in the cases where there are, like in Lebanon or in Syria, historically, and in Iraq, like historically, those divisions have been exploited and intensified by the political powers that be. Where those like tensions might not have naturally existed or manifested themselves through violence.
That's not so, unique to the Middle East. The United States, we've certainly had rich people exploit divisions between poor whites and poor blacks for their own interests as well. So this is hardly something unique to the Arab world or unique to the Middle East. Eric, my time is coming to a close. I want to appreciate, Bo, you've spent an hour with me. With our listeners, giving some really detailed analysis, and I really do appreciate it. We got about another minute left. Is there any last words that you want to say about anything we've talked about?
I'd like to say www.virtualdinnerguest.com. That's www.virtualdinnerguest.com. If you want to figure out ways to support the project and have some direct interaction with people that are living the news headlines that you're reading about right now in the coming weeks and days throughout the Middle East, get involved in the project. It's a startup, but we really need support. And the idea really is not to get people to think how I think, but to just start asking more thoughtful questions about things that are being done in their name, whether they're Americans or citizens of other countries, what's being done with their money, what's being done in their name.
We definitely need to talk with each other. It is vital that people of all different points of view hear each other and at least listen to each other. I actually think a lot of the problems that are in the world, a lot of the difficulties between human beings can be resolved if people just at least listen to the other side. So I got to point out that what you're doing is a great job, Eric, in that regard. Thank you for taking your time, spending it here on WEACT Radio on the Inside Scoop. And I hope you'll come back on my show and talk more about what you said.
Anytime. Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Thanks so much for coming on. Well, that's it. We're closing up the Inside Scoop. Wow, that was an amazing interview. I really enjoyed that with Eric Maddox. He is, of course, on the ground in Tahrir Square, or just off of Tahrir Square in Cairo. We went through Egypt and Tunisia and Lebanon and the whole Middle East, and really it was a powerful thing. And I do want to say, please do check out his website. Go and see the Virtual Dinner Guest Project. His website is right here. VirtualDinnerGuest.com, VirtualDinnerGuest.com, and support Eric in doing that. I hope you've enjoyed the Inside Scoop. We have gone a long distance today, everywhere from Fast and Furious to dressage to Rafalka to the Republicans' plans to raise taxes on the middle class to the doubling of student loans in 1 week. That's right, a week from today, your student loan rate is going to double, to a terrific analysis with Eric Maddox all across the Middle East and also the Egyptian activist Shema. It's been a fascinating show. If you missed any part of this show and you want to hear it, all you got to do is go to my website, marklevinetalk.com, marklevinetalk.com. We'll have the full broadcast there probably by the end of the day today. It'll be on the web forevermore, so you won't miss any part of anything that happened on the Inside Scoop today. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at marklevinetalk. And, of course, I will be back next week, next Sunday, right here on WEACT Radio for another edition of the Inside Scoop.